I'm here to give you a bit of an update on COPD exacerbations. I think some recent data, some of my data, and perhaps some of the way the algorithms will be changing. Now, I have, as you probably know, I am the editor of the Blue Journal. I do receive an honorarium from the ATS, but because of that, I don't accept any money from industry. So those lecture fees are prior to January 2015, and I have some grants. So I'm allowed to have grants, but no lecture fees or advisory boards. So I'm going to start off today with hyperinflation, because I think that's been the big change. We always regarded that we needed anti-inflammatory therapy to treat exacerbations. But we now know that bronchodilators are very good at preventing exacerbations, better than we ever thought they would be. And this is actually a very interesting review for anybody who is interested in this. This is from Dennis O'Donnell. I asked him when I was editor of Thorax to write a review for me on hyperinflation and issues, physiological issues at exacerbation. And you can see on the left, you can see the inspiratory capacity, and then on the right, I don't think I can point, on the right, the inspiratory capacity is much smaller. What Dennis O'Donnell emphasized in this review is that at COPD exacerbations, there is significant hyperinflation. And in fact, it's more severe than in any physiological system. And I think that is because of the viruses, which are the main etiological triggers of exacerbations, actually affecting small airways. So hyperinflation is important. And here you see the time course of an exacerbation. You can see that most exacerbations get better, as we know, in 5 to 10 days, but some don't. And in a population, 25% of patients at around 5 to 6 weeks still have symptoms of dyspnea. And this is because of the marked hyperinflation that we see in COPD, and it persists. And the hyperinflation, even when patients are recovering, it is still significant. So this is why it is very important to focus on dyspnea, not only in the basal state, but also during exacerbations. So what happens in COPD? And here is a model. This is from a paper and from some work we did with Sean Aaron, who is from Ottawa in Canada. On the left, you can see that in the stable state in COPD, you get symptom complexes. But at some point, the patient goes above the exacerbation threshold. For everybody, there is a threshold at which they feel worse. And at that point, we say that's an exacerbation. What we are doing with treatment, we are putting patients below that threshold. That's very, very important. So that they, if you improve them in the basal state, they are less likely to get an exacerbation. Now, we're learning much more about exacerbations. And on the next slide, I've got some data from a study published about 18 months ago from our group about aortic pulse wave velocity. And as you know, this is a cardiovascular risk. You can see that in both patients with airway infection, that either viruses or bacteria, or no airway infection, aortic pulse wave velocity increases. And you will see that it, like the symptoms, it persists. And at 5 weeks, exactly the same data, you still see elevation in cardiovascular risk. But what you see is that if you've got airway infection, that is higher. We know that infections are an important risk factor for cardiovascular disease. So infection at exacerbation, if you get a cold, so again, the weather is so nice here in Beirut, I don't know if you get a winter, but I think you do get a winter because you have ski resorts here, as I'm told. So you must have cold weather. And we know that in winter we get more virus infections, and you are then more likely to get exacerbations associated with hospital admissions and cardiovascular risk. But we have one very important issue, and that is the whole concept of what we call unreported or untreated exacerbations. And this was very clear. This is my first paper now written some time ago, about 17 years ago, on the topic. And we showed that 50% of our exacerbation were not reported to study teams. And in fact, when we looked at symptoms, they looked very similar. There was a suggestion that treated ones were generally more severe. But at the time, I think people didn't believe this. And in fact, all studies have used healthcare utilization, treated exacerbation as an outcome. And we looked at this further, and this shows you the importance of untreated exacerbations. And on the left, you can see we divided patients into those less than 25% of exacerbations were treated. Those patients had a worse quality of life. If your exacerbations were treated, as on the right, you had a better quality of life. So this suggested to us that these exacerbations that are not treated actually are quite important. And there's data, Paul Jones recently wrote a paper from the Aclidinium studies, again, suggesting that these untreated exacerbations also impact on quality of life, very similar to our data. So we had an opportunity to look at this. This untreated exacerbations are very difficult to study because patients don't come up. You can't sample them. But what we did, we asked patients to fill in at home the exact pro diary. This is an FDA sort of stimulated outcome PRO, which is for exacerbations. And you can see the yellow is treated, the green is untreated. You can see a lot of variability at baseline, but if you're treated, the score is higher. And so the maximum exact score is greater for treated than untreated events. But what was interesting, when we looked at the area under the curve, what we called the total exacerbation exact burden, there was actually no difference between treated or untreated exacerbations. These untreated events went for as long as they could. And, you know, we've done some more work recently and showed that actually exacerbations associated with viruses go on for a long time, don't recover, and are more likely to lead to FEV1 decline. So this is something which is difficult to sort out, but potentially very important indeed. And I think the message is, if we're doing trials, we want to collect all events. So this is some data for my group, and this is, in fact, looking at viruses in natural exacerbations, but looking at the actual load of the virus using PCR. And what you can see here is that if whether you've got a cold or no cold, that, in fact, viruses persist. This is exacerbation presentation, day 3, day 7, day 14. So if you have a cold with an exacerbation, you have a higher viral load than if you don't have a cold. Same on the right with sore throat. But there's something very important about this, is that if you look at day 7 with a cold, you still have a significant amount of virus there. And one of the problems with developing antiviral therapies has always been, can you get there fast enough with your treatment? And I think the message is, you probably have 7 days to do it, that probably up to 7 days it is worth treating patients. And hopefully this will stimulate more studies of this. So this is looking at this a little bit further. And what we've done here is that does this work or not? No, doesn't matter. There it is. This is now in yellow, the virus. But this time in green are bacteria. On the left are patients where no bacteria were detected exacerbation onset. Here, bacteria were detected. If we look at this, you can see the virus is coming down, but you can see that the bacteria, no bacteria at the beginning, you get secondary bacterial infection at day 14. And if you look here, patients were given antibiotics, down it comes. And you can see here at day 14 again, there is a rise in bacterial load. Now, I think this is very important. This may be why ICS are also linked with pneumonia. There's exacerbations and pneumonia. We know there's a lot of overlap between the two. But what this shows us is that viral infection precipitates secondary bacterial infection. And this is very important for follow-up. And in fact, in the UK, the NICE quality standard says that all patients must be followed at 14 days after an exacerbation for this very reason. So the next thing is really the whole issue of eosinophils at exacerbations. And I think this is work in progress. I think there's data, as you know, to suggest that ICS work better if you've got a blood eosinophilia of 2% or more. I think the jury is out. What it means, is this a particular type of inflammation that shows up in the blood eosinophilia? We know that frequent exacerbators have more eosinophils in their blood. So I would be actually careful. This is a study from Mona Baffadel. She was then at Leicester with Chris Breitling. And what they did is they divided patients in two groups. The standard arm, they treated normally, steroids, antibiotics. But the biomarker arm, they only treated if the eosinophils were above 2%. And you can see here, They showed basically no difference between the two arms. That actually it suggests that patients are probably given steroids unnecessarily. Again, this needs to be shown in formal randomized controlled trials. And at the moment, I think we have no choice except to give steroids and antibiotics at exacerbations. We really have no new therapies for acute exacerbations, and this is a major, major unmet need. We know antibiotics work well at exacerbations. The evidence that steroids work at exacerbations, again, is not as strong as it could be. So what about exacerbation frequency? And this was, our original paper. We showed that from year one to year two, exacerbation frequency in a population was stable. However, there is movement, and we wrote a paper from Eclipse showing that about a third of patients change exacerbation frequencies, and it is usually due to the fact that they worsen FEV1. There is still a relationship, as you can see on this slide, this is the Eclipse slide, between exacerbation frequency and lung function. GOLD 4 have a large number of exacerbations. And you'll remember the headline news in Eclipse was that 22% of patients in moderate had exacerbations in moderate and COPD. But if you look here, 40% of patients had one exacerbation, going on to 62%. So two-thirds of patients in Eclipse, even though they were optimally treated, still had an exacerbation in stage 4. So the burden is enormous. This is a paper recently published. This is the survival. This is the Eclipse data. If anybody wants to do any data on hospitalization, the power calculations are all there. And what we did here was that we looked at patients and whether they were hospitalized in year one. And if they were hospitalized in year one, what happened 2 years later? And you can see here that the patients who were hospitalized in the first year did badly in yellow over the next 2 years. So hospitalization is a particular risk factor for COPD, but some patients need to be in hospital. And this is extremely important. I think in the UK there's a drive towards community care, which may be going out of hand, is that I think patients often, if they are ill, acutely ill, a period of hospitalization, stabilization, optimization of therapy is absolutely key. So I've said already that viruses are very important, pollutants are important, they interact with viruses, and I've said that bacteria are secondary infections. And we get more airway inflammation, and that leads to dynamic hyperinflation, which is important. And we also get systemic inflammation at an exacerbation. And this is why cardiac events are associated with exacerbations, as I showed you. So how can we, in fact, intervene with exacerbations? So here you see the time course. The open circles is time outdoors. It's a very crude measure of activity. But it shows you that the activity takes longer to get better than the symptoms. So we can certainly treat the underlying symptoms. And this is what we do with bronchodilators. We reduce dyspnea so that patients go below the exacerbation threshold. We give steroids, antibiotics at the exacerbations, and maybe anti-inflammatories prevent the peak of the exacerbation. And thirdly, we can affect exacerbation recovery, so antibiotics shorten exacerbations. And I'm also going to show you how macrolides, in fact, reduce the exacerbation length and thus severity. There are very few interventions that have been studied on exacerbation length. So what is new? So what is new in the study of exacerbations? And this is important for... obviously, it's a new lab or ICS. This is velantrol, fluticasone versus velantrol. And this shows you exacerbation rates. But what is important, it's the first time that a dose response has been done of inhaled corticosteroids at exacerbations. And 50 micrograms versus 100 versus 200. So velantrol is actually the green line. But what you see, whether you have 100 or 200 micrograms, the result is very similar. And I think that's the message that's come out of a number of low-dose seretide studies. You don't need that much ICS to prevent exacerbations. And I think this is something that should have been done ages ago. We've been given much too much ICS to patients. I think using high-dose ICS should be used only probably in people with both asthma and COPD. So the next question was, you know, maybe it's a question now that life's moved on, salmeterol versus TIO is not the best comparison. Salmeterol's BD, tiotropium is daily, and we know there are adherence issues in COPD, but the exacerbation outcomes, as you can see in green, were better on tiotropium right across the measure. This was then repeated in a way, the same study. It was done more or less at the same time, this time a once-daily LABA and Decatrol against LAMA. And I think I expected it to be similar. I was actually on the data monitoring committee of this study. And again, TIA reduced exacerbations more than indicatrol. So there was a reduction of about 20% of exacerbations on the LAMA compared to the LABA. So what happens when we compare bronchodilators to LABA ICS? And the INSPIRE study was a game changer. So these were gold C&Ds, FEV1 less than 50% predicted, with one exacerbation in the previous year. And what you can see, there was no difference in exacerbation rates, whether you're on a LAMA or a LABA ICS. There were some small differences, and that was important in subgroups, that patients who were on ICS had less, perhaps, severe exacerbations. But that has never been shown in studies. We then did another study of tiotropium. This was a study looking at inflammatory markers because there was a theoretical reason why LAMAs should reduce. And what we showed was, again, in patients who were all sputum producers. This was a study sponsored by Boehringer, and we showed, again, you can see around 30% reduction of exacerbations on TIO compared to placebo. I said they were all sputum producers, and I think that is the key why LAMAs work so well on exacerbations, because sputum is related to exacerbation frequency. And if you reduce sputum, you will reduce exacerbation frequency. However, you can see the recovery time. We didn't change recovery time. So basically, bronchodilators are working on the stable state, I think, and also LAMAs on sputum. So do we need dual bronchodilators? And I got very interested in the topic. This is an interesting study from Dransfield using the General Practice Research Database. And what this shows is these were people already who had one bronchodilator, and you can see that 2/3 of patients had an MRC dyspnea score, the modified of 2, 3, and 4. So it's suggesting that there is a lot of dyspnea out there which is not treated. And what do we have at the moment? Well, we have umeclidinium and vilantrol, we have aclidinium and formoterol, and we have QVA 149 Ultibro, which is glycoprodium and indicatrol, and Boehringer also have a dual. And we know that these compounds can increase FEV1. Again, the yellow line shows that umeclidinium vilantrol can increase FEV1 compared to the components. And here we have the Ultibro, again, QVA149, that's Ultibro, 200 mils. So we know that FEV1's improved compared to the components, including tiotropium. That's tiotropium, glycoprodium, indicatrol, the dual is better. Now, there's a general rule that if you improve FEV1, you will also improve other outcomes. So this is now going on to the SPARK study. So this was a study where Ultibro QVA149 in patients with FEV1 below 50% predicted, so C's and D's, again, was compared to a LAMA. And if you add two bronchodilators, you get a 12% reduction in the rate of moderate or severe exacerbations. Now, tiotropium was open label, and there was a 10% reduction, but it didn't reach statistical significance, probably because it was open label, and that will always reduce the size of the effect. But when we looked at all exacerbations here on the left, so this is now mild, moderate, and severe exacerbations. On the Ultibro QVA149, there was a 15% reduction in exacerbations because we collected these untreated, unreported exacerbations, and there were a lot of them. There were almost three times more untreated exacerbations than there were treated exacerbations. Interestingly, severe, there were very few hospitalizations because we used diary cards and monitoring for the patients. This shows you the health status. The blue is Ultibro, the dual bronchodilator. At each time point, over 64 weeks, this is 15 months, there was a reduction in SGRQ, improvement in health status at each time point. And we're not used to seeing such tight SGRQ data. And SGRQ health status is very closely related to exacerbations. And again, this is patient-reported symptoms. You can see they were reduced, the lower, the better. And on the left, daily symptoms, on the right, daily dyspnea, and again, symptoms relate to exacerbations. And the same with rescue medication. We've shown many times, you can see that glycopronium and tiotropium are very similar on rescue medication, but Ultibro, in fact, shows a bigger reduction of rescue medication. And in fact, that's important because rescue medication is often the earliest sign of exacerbations. So what happens if we withdraw ICS? So if we are going to use more LABA/LAMAs, now I would, this is the wisdom study. The issue to remember, these were very severe patients. I actually would try withdrawing ICS first in mild, moderate COPD and then move on to more severe patients. But you'll know this data, there was no difference in exacerbations when steroids were withdrawn. There were some issues about design. There's a lot of patients were put on ICS and then withdrawn. There was, however, a small fall in FEV1. My own view on this is that I wouldn't get too upset about this. If you give roflumilast or ICS to patients, you see a small improvement in FEV1, which is probably due to airway wall edema. So I think if you want to take ICS off, I think it's safe. We have better bronchodilators. That is the answer. And I think most of the steroid withdrawal effects are symptoms, which we can now control with our dual bronchodilators. So I'm going to just finish off. These are my last few slides. And this is, in fact, macrolides and long-term macrolide treatment. And this is the study that we did, published in the Blue Journal, and we showed that erythromycin was better than placebo. And we showed what this is, I think, the important data, that we showed that exacerbation duration on the left, you can see there are more longer studies on the left, while if you go to the right, you can see that there are more exacerbations here that are, in fact, shorter. So this actually, I said acute antibiotics shorten exacerbations, so do long-term. This is, in fact, the American study. They showed exactly the same thing with azithromycin. They used 250 daily. I would use 250 three times a week. They did have quite a lot of side effects, including vestibular, and there are also potential cardiac effects, so one has to be careful. This is, in fact, the REACT study recently published, and this was now adding roflumilast to inhaled corticosteroids, and this was always the criticism that, in fact, there was no data what happens on top of ICS. On the left, the intention to treat just missed statistical significance, P equals 0.053. On the right, if you did a per protocol, these are the patients who took and finished the study. There was a reduction in exacerbations. They saw a bigger effect on severe exacerbations on the left, and on the right, hospital admissions. And you can see that this data was statistically significant. So you have an option once a patient is on triple therapy. One can move on to roflumilast. The problem is that obviously there are side effects. What about statins? That was a study, in fact, published last year, showed absolutely no effect. And I would have told you there'd be no effect. There's no reason why a statin should actually reduce exacerbation. If you're going to do studies, they must have a plausible mechanism. So I've shown you today how important exacerbations are. There is a vicious circle from the stable state to exacerbation. Symptoms are key. And also the recovery of the exacerbation is important. And in the middle, I've shown you all the issues that you have: more susceptibility to viral, more bacteria, disease progression increases, quality of life, anxiety and depression. We haven't had a chance to talk about that. Very important. More comorbidity and death. Thank you very much indeed.